Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 22, and we've entered the second week of November 1942. The struggle by the 6th Army to take the remnants of the Russian 62nd Army clinging onto the banks of the Volga River is about to take another turn, with General Paulus ordering another assault on the 11th of November. This followed the German High Command's realization that they had to do something urgently to beef up Paulus's exposed flanks. The Germans had formed a salient or wedge as they pushed towards Stalingrad, and it was ripe for the plucking. The 48th Panzer Corps had been based 50 miles southwest of the ominous bridgeheads at Kletskaya and Serafimovich on the Don River, when its commander, Lieutenant General Ferdinand Heim, received orders to move up to the threatened sector. That was to the northeast, and the unit duly clanked onto the road. But only a few miles after starting out, major problems emerged, and it involved mice. The column ground to a halt. Some of the tanks actually caught fire. For others, the engines were misfiring, and many then failed to run at all. Mechanics swarmed over the vehicles and discovered that field mice had nested inside the vehicles and gnawed away at the insulation covering the electrical systems. It was days later that they limped on their way again. Eventually, the 48th arrived at its new quarters, but it was virtually crippled. Out of 104 tanks in the 22nd Panzer Division, for example, only 42 were ready for combat. No one notified High Command or Hitler. He would have had a fit. So, on the 11th of November, with their flanks bolstered to some extent, the Germans attacked. It began just before dawn, led by the newly organized battle groups from the 71st, 79th, 100th, 295th, 305th, and 389th Infantry Divisions, reinforced with four fresh pioneer or specialist engineers. They were aiming to dislodge the pockets of resistance, or as the Germans put it, the rectangles. And above, Freie von Richthofen's Luftwaffe prepared the way. The general had lost almost all patience with what he regarded as army conventionality, or in another word, slowness. He had complained repeatedly about the artillery failing to fire and the infantry not making use of his bombing attacks. Well, it was easy for him to say. His men were hundreds of feet above Stalingrad, hardly feeling the pain of the most dramatic battle in history. That, of course, would change only in a little while. The aviators were to become deeply embroiled in ground fighting at times as the Russians launched their counterattack in a few days. During the morning of the 11th, the bombing runs ordered by Paulus had one spectacular moment. They managed finally to knock down the massive factory chimneys in the Barikadi. On Mamiev Kurgan, the hill that dominated Stalingrad, Batyuk Siberians fought desperately to retain their foothold on the high ground, but it was not Paulus's main point of attack on the 11th. That was further north, towards the Lazur Chemical Factory, in the area known as the Tennis Racket because of the shape of the railway line around the industrial complex. Leading the attack in this area was the German 305th Infantry Division and most of the expert pioneer battalions. They managed to capture key buildings, but the Russians retook these just as swiftly. Then the 305th halted as they had lost too many men. In the north of Stalingrad, Ludnikov's 138th Rifle Division was fighting fiercely as they were cut off behind the Barikadi factory with their backs to the Volga. Each rifleman was now down to an average of 30 rounds for both the long guns and submachine guns, and they were running out of food. The small Russian U-2 biplanes, which the Germans feared so much, flew overhead at night dropping sacks of ammunition, but this caused more problems. The rounds were partly damaged in the fall and jammed many firearms. Once more, the Barikadi was singled out for special attention. On the night of the 11th of November, the 62nd Army launched attacks led by the 95th Rifle Division southeast of the plant. The main intention was to prevent the Germans from withdrawing troops to protect their flanks. General Choikov believed he had a chance of success until the German artillery stopped the 95th in its tracks. Early in the morning of the 12th of November, a hurricane of fire caused the 95th to dive for cover, and that barrage lasted from 5 until 6:30. A strong force of German infantry followed up the barrage and drove a wedge between two of the Russian rifle regiments. Just before 10 a.m., the Germans sent in reinforcements, which advanced on the petrol tanks on the banks of the Volga. It was touch and go if this latest assault was going to be successful. Would the 62nd lose this sector of the battle? A Soviet rifle regiment managed to hold off the main attack, while other assault groups hit the Germans in the flanks and slowed them down. Three German tanks were set on fire, and the Russian regiment was taking huge casualties at the same time. It was cut and thrust here in late autumn, with temperatures below freezing. Eventually, the Soviet rifle regiment was down to 15 men who managed somehow to hold onto the bank until another battalion arrived to relieve them. There was only one man who survived at the regiment's guard post, and he'd had his right hand smashed by shrapnel. He rushed down into the bunker, filled his cap with grenades, and told the survivors that, "I can throw them with my left hand." Close by, another regiment was down to 4 men, and then their ammunition ran out. A wounded man crawled out of the fighting zone carrying a message. "Begin shelling our position. In front of us is a large group of fascists. Farewell, comrades. We did not retreat." The situation became even more desperate because of ice flows on the Volga. Icebreakers were being used, but the Germans obviously targeted these with a particular intensity. Meanwhile, General Paulus, physically, was close to collapse. His doctor warned him he was heading for a breakdown and needed to rest. He was making rash decisions as well. For example, he ordered tank crews awaiting their new Mark IV Panzers to be formed up into an infantry regiment and then to be used in ground fighting. Panzer commanders were horrified at such a mad waste. But Paulus refused to cancel the order. In the end, the commanders tried to bypass it by assembling units of cooks, orderlies of all types, signal staff, in fact, anybody but the experienced tank crews, just to show Paulus that their divisions appeared operational. General von Seydlitz at the same time was suffering from an extremely high casualty rate. 6th Army headquarters judged that 42% of his battalions were fought out. Most infantry companies now were down to under 50 men and were being amalgamated in the same manner in which the Russians had reorganized their battered battalions. The worst casualty rate was among the officers and NCOs. Only a tiny minority of the original combatants who arrived in Stalingrad remained on both sides. "These were different Germans from those we had fought in August," said one Soviet veteran interviewed by historian Anthony Beaver. "And we were also different. Frontline soldiers knew that the best and most courageous died first in Stalingrad." A strong sense of foreboding grew at this time. The Germans, such as General von Richthofen, had seen the Russian build-up and reflected in his diary on the 12th of November that "the Russians are resolutely carrying on with their preparations for an offensive against the Romanians. Their reserves had now been concentrated. When, I wonder, will the attack come? Guns are beginning to make their appearance in artillery emplacements. I can only hope that the Russians won't tear too many big holes in the line." The plan for Operation Uranus had actually begun as early as September. It was going to be a great counterstroke against the 6th Army and had an unusually long gestation, as Beaver puts it. Russian President Joseph Stalin was usually much more impatient for results, but this time his desire for revenge, which we all know is a meal best eaten cold, had led to a comprehensive plan and a steely resolve to wait until everything was just right before smashing into the Germans. General Zhukov had been summoned to the Kremlin on the 12th of September after the failed attack on Paulus's northern flank. He was met at the Kremlin by Vasilevsky, the chief of staff. "Why had the attack failed?" asked Stalin, as he sat in his office, overlooked by recently installed portraits of Alexander Suvorov, the scourge of the Turks in the 18th century, and Mikhail Kutuzov, Napoleon's dogged adversary. Zhukov explained that an understrength army lacking artillery and tanks led to defeat. Stalin wanted to know how to fix that problem. Zhukov said he wanted a full-strength army, backed up by a tank corps, 3 armored brigades, at least 400 howitzers, and a full-sized air force. The Soviet dictator ordered the men to head off for 24 hours and return to his office with ideas of how they would achieve this new army. A day later, they were back. Surprisingly, Stalin shook them both by the hand, which he never did.
"Well, what have you come up with?" he demanded. "Who's making the report?"
Both generals were of the same opinion. Stalingrad should be kept in a state of attrition, thus keeping the Germans too busy to deal with any information they may receive about a build-up of forces north and south of the city. Choikov and his 62nd Army were the expendables. There would be no more wasteful medium-sized counterattacks unless the west bank of the Volga was about to fall. As Paulus's mind was concentrated on the day-to-day fighting, the Russians would assemble fresh armies behind the lines for a major encirclement, deep thrusts far behind the point of the German apex. Stalin thought it was a bad plan initially, but soon realized that a large-scale gamble was far better than a piecemeal hodgepodge. They had tried the latter repeatedly, and it had failed repeatedly. And of course, his great military advantage over Adolf Hitler was his lack of ideological shame. He was not embarrassed in the slightest to reinstate the military thinking of the 30s, where he'd had Soviet officers executed for even suggesting some of the methods. That was deep operations in the enemy's rear using mechanized shock armies. So permission was given back in September, and then Zhukov went to work. He was not just a good planner, he was also the best implementer of plans. It was troop training that was most important. The half-trained soldiers they'd sent into the faulty counterattacks of September and October was basically a death warrant for these poor men and women. Oddly, by sending many units far east to train them properly, German intelligence was also mostly confused. The German head of Fremder Heere Ost, Colonel Reinhard Galen, was convinced any reports of a large army north of Stalingrad was not going to head to the city, but probably would target towns further north. Part of Zhukov's plan did involve a fairly significant diversionary attack against Army Group Center. We had heard last episode how Romanian General Dumitrescu had already warned Paulus that he believed his men were exposed in the north and would be an easy target. He also picked up some of the Russian movements, despite the fact that Zhukov was employing many secrecy tricks. Secrecy and deception plans were vital to camouflage their preparations, yet the Red Army had two even more effective advantages in its favor. The first was that Hitler refused to believe that the Soviet Union had any reserve armies, let alone tanks, required for any counter-offensive. The second German misconception was even more helpful. All the ineffective attacks mounted against the 14th Panzer Corps on the northern flank near Stalingrad had made the Red Army appear incapable of mounting a dangerous offensive in the region, least of all a swift and massive encirclement of the entire 6th Army. Remember, during the summer, I explained how General Halder had told Hitler that the Soviet Union was producing 1,200 tanks a month, while Germany was only managing 500. Hitler slammed his fist on the table and said it was simply not possible. Halder was wrong. At this point, the Soviet Union was actually producing 2,200 tanks a month, double the figure that Hitler had questioned as impossible. Aircraft production had ramped up to 15,800 in the second half of 1942, from 9,600 in the first half. The Germans were being outproduced. One main reason for this was the role women were playing. As with the United States and Great Britain, women were building most of the machines in the factories in Russia. At a time when Hitler refused to countenance the idea of German women in factories, Soviet production depended on the mass mobilization of mothers and daughters. Tens of thousands of dungareed women, or fighters in overalls, as they were called, swung tank turrets on hoists down production lines, bent over lathes, and were involved in the fighting itself. When the 1st Ural Volunteer Tank Regiment of Workers was established, it received 4,363 applications, of which 1,253 were women. Allied support was also becoming a major factor. Later, the Russians tried to play this down. The reality is, the food and trucks in particular sent by the Americans was one of the main reasons why the Soviets continued to resist so effectively. All those tins of Spam from Chicago, those tens of thousands of tons of white wheat sacks stamped with the American eagle, and most importantly, thousands of Jeeps, Fords, and Studebakers. The plans for Operation Uranus were simple yet daringly ambitious at the same time. The main assault was set to take place over 100 miles west of Stalingrad and would be launched southeastwards from the Serafimovich Bridge head. This was a 40-mile stretch south of the Don River, which the Romanian Third Army did not have the strength to protect. Dumitrescu had been warning about this for quite some time. The point of the attack was so far to the rear of the 6th Army that the German mechanized forces in and around Stalingrad would not be able to get back in time to make any difference, or to get away. This was Zhukov's aggressive masterstroke. Remember, too, that Hitler had ordered most of the horses, mules, and camels, and other animals to be removed from the area between the Don and the Volga, and to be rehoused far to the rear. So, who was going to move the heavy artillery based around Stalingrad? But that wasn't all. The Russians planned an inner strike south of Stalingrad, where armor would be used to punch a large hole northwestwards to meet up with the main assault in the area of Kalach. And thus, the 6th Army would be encircled, as well as part of Hoth's 4th Panzer Army. Incredibly, 60% of the entire tank strength of the Red Army in Russia was allocated to Operation Uranus. The Germans didn't have a hope facing this sort of power. The terrible truth for the Germans on the 14th of November was that even if they'd managed to discover the full extent of the operation, it was too late. In fact, it had been too late for at least 2 weeks. German intelligence had picked up some movement, but overall had failed spectacularly to identify the creation of 5 new tank armies, each of which was equivalent to a panzer corps. Russia had also created 15 new tank corps, each the size of a panzer division. The moment of retribution was drawing near, and Stalin's ice-cold approach was going to pay off. The Soviets paid a great deal of attention to what was known as maskirovka, a term meaning deception, camouflage, and operational security. They reduced the amount of radio traffic. Orders were given in person, not written down. Russian divisions began to move around near Moscow, adding to German confusion. In the area earmarked for a fast-moving attack north of Stalingrad, the Russians spent a great deal of time building what looked like permanent bases, as though the units were digging in for a long winter. At the Voronezh front, units were told to prepare bridging equipment and boats, as if an offensive was being planned there. Of course, being closer to Moscow, the Germans naturally believed that Stalin's fear of losing the capital would mean any Russian counter-offensive would take place closer to where he was based. Approach marches were made at night, never during the day, which was an extremely difficult task to achieve on the vast open plains of the steppe, but the Russians were adept at hiding on flat ground. 17 false bridges were constructed over the Don, far from the 5 bridges the Russians were actually going to use in the north of Stalingrad. The 5th Tank Army, along with the 4th Tank Corps, were just about ready to do the crossing and attack the Romanians, along with 2 cavalry corps and numerous rifle divisions. South of Stalingrad, the methods used to hide movements were even more elaborate. The 13th, along with the 4th Mechanized Corps, the 4th Cavalry Corps, and supporting formations, was actually a vast army. These totaled 160,000 men, 430 tanks, 550 guns, 14,000 vehicles, and over 10,000 horses. They were brought across the lower Volga in batches at night, an extremely dangerous operation, with the ice flows threatening at any moment. On the 15th of November, back in Berlin, the newspaper Das Reich carried an article by Joseph Goebbels, Minister of Propaganda. This appeared to signal a shift in thinking by the German establishment. Goebbels had decided to prepare the German people for any eventuality, including disaster in Russia. "We have thrown the national existence into the balance," he wrote. "There is no turning back now." Zhukov and Vasilevsky were not idle. They had been shuttling back and forth between Moscow, Stalingrad, and other points along the front. They checked the preparations and declared themselves satisfied. The northern front of Operation Uranus would attack on the 19th of November, and the southern a day later. Stalin approved the plan without a comment. This time, there was to be no panicky threat. It was steely resolve. And the weather was getting worse, and the Russian partisans were causing disruptions as equipment failed to arrive. Ammunition was being blown up, trains derailed. Things were going to descend into a real hell, and really quickly for the Germans in Stalingrad. We'll halt now and peer out our maps, brew up some tea, and perhaps eat a spoonful or two of the dreaded spam. Next episode, we'll deal with the first week of Operation Uranus. Thank you to Adam, who's a postgrad student in Sheffield in the UK. Great email, and good luck with your plans to visit Volgograd, which is the new name of Stalingrad, of course. And to Walter, thank you again for your support, sir. Please remember to rate the podcast on iTunes. You can also contact me on Twitter at Des Latham or through my website, abwarpodcast.com. Until next week, goodbye.